Good morning, how are you? I hear you really got here today.
Good morning.
Hey, buddy.
How are you?
Good.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Did we get a phone call?
That's right.
Did we do a phone call? Okay, let's do that. It's always good. Yeah, it's fun to chat.
Okay. You want me to do the man of white?
Yes.
Stand up here.
So, yeah, let's chat.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, just to give a little background on the letter. Come to us. Oh, let's have this conversation. Absolutely.
Oh, really?
Just get it. We're all ready.
Yep.
No different than normal.
Excited? Good morning, everyone.
It's like starting day of football.
Right? No, that's tomorrow.
One more time.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning. We do have a quorum. My name is Bill, and I work for her. To my left.
Beth Bassett would leave. Patty Klein, Connecticut District.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Sorry, Todd Henry, Sacramento Sheriff's Department.
Dan Monk, Sacramento Police Department.
Cindy Kavanaugh, County of Sacramento.
Deanne Dwyer, Downtown Partnership.
Emily Hopkins, City of Sacramento.
Charles Ware.
Sarah Bontrager, City of Elk Grove.
John Foley, Sacramento, South Health Housing.
Jason Henry, Veterans Resource Veterans of America.
David Busey, Cottage Island.
Michelle Watts, Sacramento Steps 4.
Ryan Luke Pearl, Sacramento Steps 4.
Joan Burke, Lowson, Christian.
Dorothy Lansford, with George Civil Law. Casey Nippelberg, New York Civil Law.
Bruno Califano, Salvation Army.
Ben Fleming, with Mercy Housing.
Arturo Bayaki from Sac State.
Keith Hobson, also from Sac State.
Gabrielle Salazar, Sacramento Steps 4.
Jeff Tardigia, member of various groups advocating for homeless transportation and other interesting aspects.
Hi, I'm Corey, Sacramento County Public Health.
Mike Jaskin, Sacramento Ed.
Eve Hutchinson, Lincoln Social Services.
Ben Avey, Sacramento Steps Forward.
Carolyn.
Carolyn Frode.
Again, good morning, everyone. We have your minutes in your packet. And a motion to accept.
So
moved.
Second.
We have a first and a second. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstention? Motion carries. My part of the meeting is
over. Great job.
For the chair's report, I think I will hold the comments because they have to do with the point in time now. But a great concern to us at Loaves and Fishes, and of course to everyone in this room, is the fact that the unsheltered, if you use the uncorrected number, the number of unsheltered doubled in 2 years. So I think while we all know that housing is the answer to ending homelessness, we also have to answer the question, where do I sleep at night? And that has become more and more critical. So I think we should prioritize that in everything that we do. This winter is going to be very, very difficult with that, with having more people unsheltered than sheltered in terms of the homeless population. And now the chair's report.
Now, I want to give our presenters plenty of time to have a point time count. We've got lots of questions, so I just got to move that as the report.
Okay. The NOFA updates?
Yes. Okay, as I'm sure everyone, or almost everyone knows, the NOFA was released, I think, just a couple of days after our last advisory board meeting. The competition is in full swing at this point, with all of our providers working hard to complete their local applications as well as the standard eSNAPs federal applications for their projects. Those materials will be reviewed by the Review and Rank Panel, which is a subset of your Performance Review Committee of the folks without conflict of interest. They'll be meeting August 28th to 29th for a pretty intensive two-day review. We really appreciate their efforts to contribute to the really competitive process. So that's upcoming. We'll ask that information then will come to this board at the beginning of September, and we do need to change your regular September meeting date in order to complete our work on the approving of the review and rank list in time for it to be posted for the mandatory number of days before the application back to the Utah. So you'll see on the bottom of your agenda, the next meeting is tentatively proposed for Tuesday, September 12th. It's actually just one day early. And right now we're looking at the time frame of 8 to 9:30. But Gabrielle will follow up after this meeting with a poll to confirm that we have a quorum at that time. And in the event that we don't, we will have to attempt to find another time, either on the 11th or 12th, that we do have a quorum. It's really important that all of you are engaged in what might be your most important job of the year. So we'll work hard to make sure that happens. I should say, in between the approval of the application for the ranked list by your panel and the approval by this board, there's also an opportunity for appeals. And that will require several of you to volunteer to participate as members of the appeals panel. So I'll be reaching out to folks to recruit that group. It'd be great if we don't have any appeals, but we do have a very precise outline process that we need to use it. So following then the approval of the ranked list by this group on the 11th or 12th, that will get posted. Any projects that are being defunded will have official notification of that. That is in fact the case. But it may be necessary to conduct a second meeting in September to deal with other COC applications. So I just wanted to put that on folks' radar. The full package is due by September 28th. So in the event that we need to come together to approve additional materials, another requirement, say a community application that's new, we would give you plenty of notice and convene a meeting sometime in that third week of September. So I'll be sure to make sure that gets communicated out to everyone if it's necessary to do that. And that's kind of where we are, generally speaking, with the NOFA competition. And then I have a second NOFA item if folks don't have questions. All right. We have an opportunity, and this has been an opportunity for the last several years, to apply for a fair amount of funds for the purpose of planning, continuum of care planning activities. I'm going to pass out a handout that goes over what's eligible. It's page 75 and 76. Pulled right out of that interim role. So as I said, we have an opportunity to apply for over $555,000 in planning monies for this continuum of care for a one-year grant. I'm going to wait a couple minutes or seconds until the paper makes its play around the rooms to find out what we might do. So this right on the right, starting on page 75, outlines exactly what we can do.
75,
so the beginning is a description of how the dollar amount is calculated. But again, it's $555,000 for Sacramento in this competition. Planning costs can include developing a community-wide or region-wide process involving the coordination of nonprofit homeless providers, service providers, et cetera. That's kind of what we already have in place here with this advisory board. So we're in good shape to have the planning body in place. We can also use the funds to determine the geographic area that the COC will serve. That's pretty well locked in here in Sacramento COC, but that's something other COCs may find funds useful for. Developing a continuum of care system, and that is a pretty broad bullet point, which opens things up for us to do all sorts of planning activities around how our, what we call here, the crisis response system, how that operates, how we can improve its operations. Also evaluating outcomes of projects for which funds are awarded in the geographic area, including the Emergency Solutions Grant Program, has specifically called out ESG in this regulation, which pertains to the COC program, because there are a lot of funded projects, and we really want to see a lot of coordination between ESG and COC program projects that this advisory group is responsible for. And for folks who might not know, ESG funds emergency shelter and rescue. And in this community fund. We can also use the funds to participate in consolidated plan development. We can use the funds for preparing and submitting our HUD application. And then we can also use those funds for monitoring. At this time, there's a fair amount of monitoring happening in our community in terms of the SSF managed projects, which is funded by our admin collectively. But you could also use planning dollars to do additional monitoring. One thing that I didn't specifically state here, I kind of skipped over it right above, is using it for a time count, which we have done in the past, and we will definitely want to include in the use of this planning funding. It's great to have this much funding available on a cycle that will align with funding our 2019 point in time count. So we really have resources won't be an issue, assuming we are awarded this funding for the point time count in terms of what we can do if we can. But I think that we could also engage in additional planning activities considering the amount of the grant is about what we need for the point time count. One thing that I mentioned this at the executive director's meeting, which is actually how it was requested to be placed on today's agenda. One thing that came up was the gaps analysis, which we actually already have underway with our TA provider, but it is something that is best used in a sort of iterative, ongoing fashion. So it could be that we could continue that work with this funding or enhance that work. So I'll take input on what other things our planning needs are, what they would most like to see these funds used for. Sacramento Steps Forward is the collaborative applicant, and we're going to let you complete the application, but we're happy to be collaborative and figure it out.
Is it competitive? I mean, are you just automatically going to get this money, or?
Well, it's all competitive, but it's not included in our ranked list, sort of held aside. And the competitive feature, I think, is more how we do on that COC application. So, we've performed well in the past. We received planning grants. This would be our third planning grant.
And what have we done in previous years?
So we've used it for the, we actually were a little delayed in executing the agreements, but so we're in the first cycle now, and we use that funding for part of the point in time count, along with support from our local government partners, and for the the work that we do with home base for those of you in the race.
And if you have a specific recommendation for what we should fund with this year?
Just that it should definitely be the point in time count, and we should really look to enhance the resources there so that we can do everything that we want to do instead of having to make some trade-offs. And then, you know, we're doing this gaps analysis, the free TA is only going to take us so far, so.
Right, I think to get that real in-depth gaps analysis for population, subpopulation, that we should consider using these dollars to get us that.
Thanks, Cindy. Listening.
How does this amount compare to, say, last year? And also, is it a choice on whether you fund projects or planning? In other words, it reduces your project.
This amount, in the last two cycles, we did not apply for the full amount. So it is significantly more than we've applied for, but I don't believe I think we maybe were eligible to apply for that much in the past, but didn't have projects in mind. And it is a separate pot of money. It does not impact any of our projects.
Do you have the amount from us last time?
I would be guessing.
Okay.
But I can have Gabrielle share that out with you group after we provide the last two cycles.
Thank you.
Thank you. How much have we spent on the point in time count in the past? What is the cost of that project?
$130,000. Is that our part or is that total? That just was SSX spend?
That's
or?
The total, and it's definitely been a collaborative
funding
effort.
So, I'm supportive of asking for a substantial amount of money for essentially developing a plan in homelessness. The CSC board 2 years ago adopted a plan about how to improve this operation, but that plan never really was put into effect. It wasn't really complete in the sense of where would the money come, you know, what is our target date, what is our real population, what are the needs of the population, how much money does it take to get one? We need that kind of plan. The Sacramento Act has been urging the county and the city to develop a comprehensive plan. We're not going to give up on that. To the extent there's a resource here that would facilitate, you know, that kind of activity, I strongly urge that we put in our application.
So what are you anticipating the processes then for making a decision about how much you're going to apply for and what you're going to use it for?
So this is the first time that we really have engaged the advisory board in this process. I think number one, as an SSF executive team, we're committed to applying for a full amount this time and making sure that we have meaningful projects that can spend that money well. The outcome of today's conversation can inform the rest of the process that we follow here, but SSF will take the lead on preparing the application. You can work with your executive committee or an ad hoc group to review the draft and get your feedback on how that works. Realistically, it would probably be input today, us going back and doing the work and then convening maybe one more meeting just between now and the NOFA time-wise to get additional.
So I would recommend doing that. It does seem like it would be helpful for the COC, and honestly, haven't had a chance to think about it enough to be able to meaningfully give you advice other than it would be nice to be engaged a little bit more before a final decision, since it is such a significant amount of resource that appears to be new, wouldn't impact our other projects, but could perhaps enhance our ability to get additional resources. So I would like to ask that something come back either to the COC or a committee.
I'd be particularly interested in the calling more gaps analysis. That provides great information continually that we can address the need where are our people going to sleep tonight rather than 2 years down the road when we're building more housing. We need that to develop the market.
Right.
Thanks, John. I'm wondering when the money's actually going to be available and how far out the plan would have to go.
So the funds will be for the 2018-19 cycle. And with the planning grant, the exact month of 2018 that it starts in is up to us. So, yeah.
So could you start in January?
We could, well, if we start in January, then we wouldn't be able to fund everything for the point in time count that happens the next January. So I'd recommend that we start April so that we can go through. Because we have to spend the money in the month that the costs are incurred and that the costs will be happening. A lot of them will be happening in the beginning of 2019.
Okay. So are there what happened to planning activities that I don't know if you have anything in mind, but if you didn't apply for this, where would you get the money? Meaning, what's the best outcome here for you? What do you want? You want us to say yes to this, obviously. But what if either you're not awarded or say no, not awarded? What happens? What are the planning activities and what happens?
So we've had some recurring partners on the point in time count. So we would, in addition to our own fundraising, be looking to those partners to help us again in the event that we weren't funded for this. And then the way that we've typically been able to engage in other planning activities has been through either TA that HUD has offered us, TA that we've asked for from HUD and been approved to receive, and then through some other activities with private funders, we've been able to do enhanced work with data and things like that. So this is a really great opportunity to have a dedicated source of funds for planning, to carry out some of these activities, especially things like the point in time count that have previously or traditionally been unfunded mandates, to actually have a funding source for that. So we'll definitely, the full cost of the point in time count will be built into this application.
Could these dollars be used? I feel like part of what we're missing as a community is the ability to plan community-wide, not just continuum-wide. So specifically, I mean, city, county, and the CFC. Could these dollars be used to engage in planning with the city and county and the CFC for a county-wide system to serve?
Yeah. It's my understanding that we could develop, even if it was under the guise of the COC, the community plan that would include our partners. From what I understand,
that looks exactly like us.
Emily? So, given that it sounds like in previous years you haven't applied for the full amount and it wouldn't have affected the project, should I infer from that means that there's some punitive thing if you don't spend it? I'm trying to figure out why we didn't apply before, but then what's the repercussions if we apply, get it, and then don't spend it? I'm making that leap, and maybe that's incorrect.
So I can speak to, I think it's never good to not spend all your grant, regardless of what kind of grant it is, from that perspective. I mean, that can be a real problem. But the reason that we didn't apply for the full amount in the past is because of our capacity during the period of time in which applications are prepared. So we applied for what we knew we could do, and we're focused on project applications and the continuum of care application as our priorities. So we did what we could on the planning grant, but we have more capacity.
So if you apply, do you have to name specific things, and then if you don't fulfill those things, is there the potential of a repercussion from HUD yanking your phone?
So the best, in the event, it's happened before that things we proposed and haven't quite come together, and the best way to handle that is to do a grant amendment during or early on in that cycle, as soon as you can forecast that, oh, this is going to come together the way that we're doing. So staying on top of what's in your grant so that you can be sure to deliver on it is, we would avoid repercussions by handling it that faster. But if we did nothing.
But you do have to name particular outputs. So you will have to name point in time count gaps, and you will have to name those.
Exactly. Yes.
I'm with Kathy that I would like to give input more considered. However, I still have some input, which is I think we really are missing data. So even to do a plan, to do a process, to do a community, the more we can do to get good data. So the gaps analysis was mentioned. I think we do not also have a systematic way of evaluating outcomes across programs, and that's mentioned here. So I would promote sort of that data groundwork so that we can do good planning and processes.
Use it for staffing and...
Yeah, because we have, we're hiring for an analyst position in the database expert that's coming on too, so we may be able to use that to make it more robust. And I'd like to be able to form a team that has our primary funding partners and then a partnership with the institutional learning that does social research as well. That would give both a view and understanding of our literal homelessness, but then also look upstream a little bit so we understand better the inflow and causes of homelessness.
Yes. Foreigner.
That's coming from the perspective of watching the IHSS trying to do coordinated care over the last 5 years, and the state saying it's not working. Just am interested to see, to make sure we learn what mistakes were made in helping us coordinate care, because for IHSS, the state said it's back to the counties now, level-wise. And I think you're talking about federal dollars here, and just being sure that we know how we're utilizing these things. And hope that that's a helpful comment, please.
So if this money, with this grant, would you be accountable to this advisory board and somebody about what you're doing with this?
It's part of the right. Packet that you approved. So in that sense, we would be.
And I think we're talking about it as we've reviewed and discussed this body.
But I think we align with what the regulations require, which, you know, we're beholden to, and the advisory board is, and those things align, sort of to you.
I think we have more responsibility, maybe, than we've taken in the past for what we've done with this money grant. And in the sense that we don't expect to hold us accountable to actually hold you accountable. You know what I mean?
So, sorry, going back to Cindy and Kathy's point and what you just said, Michelle, since you have to submit the application with specific projects and you also want input and I hear people want to give up, but how do you imagine those two things happening in the time frame that you have?
So, we already know that we'll be putting the point in time count in. And then I'm hearing comments that I could see sort of coming together into a second item with several components, leading toward, you know, data for planning, working toward having a comprehensive strategic plan, but really focusing on data and gaps analysis in this cycle. So I would take what I'm hearing here today, draft the application, and then convene a work group before the next couple weeks, I'd say. I'll have to look at competition calendar and figure out where to plug it in, but then share it with the group that way and then report on what we decided on at one of the advisory board meetings.
Erin, one last thing. I think that for me, we've been talking a lot about having this board be a place where we really do that kind of planning, make a plan, have a target, as Mike described. Using the point in time count, using the gaps analysis to do that. And if this money comes up every cycle, pretty much, then it seems like it would be really good for us to early on be having that part of our dialogue about what are we gonna apply for next year when this money exists, and how are we gonna take that money to move our community forward, so that we aren't, you know, August and it's due in 3 weeks and, you know, people want input. So, I don't know, just a recommendation for maybe starting like right after this NOFA on what are we gonna do next year and how does it move forward?
And just to add to that, what we could also do when the work group convenes to look at this year's draft, we could start to lay out what that calendar looks like for ongoing
Any more comments or questions? Any point in time?
We have our guest from Sacramento State.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Feel like I'm at a dissertation defense.
Oh, that was much.
I know.
That was much easier. That was much easier.
Fair assessment.
My name is Arturo Biocchi. I'm an assistant professor at Sac State in social work. And I'm here with my colleague, Keith Hodson. He will be the clicker. We're testing out new technology today. He has great abilities beyond just pressing the site. we're going to talk a little bit about the point in time count for 2017 and the role that Sac State played in the project. Starting out, I just want to say it was a great opportunity for the university and our students to participate in this issue. I do research on homelessness. And it was great to get our students involved at multiple stages of this project, including some of the surveys, but also the kind of analytics part of it. Now, we were kind of brought into this process a little bit late. We actually signed the contract with Sacramento Steps Forward on January 10th or something like that, which was about 15 days before the point in time count. And so we had to do quite a bit of scrambling, and I'm proud to say that the team really came through. I think we did we did a great job. I think my team did a good job meeting the challenge. Go ahead, clicker to the next stage. So today's presentation, I'll try to keep it about 40, 50 minutes. If that's okay, if we run out of time, we can skip some slides. But generally, I'm going to start out by just talking about some of the key findings. The report has been out for a little while at this point. And so we're just going to go over the kind of big findings of this report. We're talking a little bit about the contextual factors that we think are important to consider, specifically for the unsheltered count. Then we're going to spend more time talking about the methodology of the point in time count. We made some decisions to change things a little bit to improve or enhance the accuracy of the unsheltered count. And so we'll talk a little bit about what that looked like. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the challenges and lessons learned from our experiences and some recommendations that we are going to put forward towards the board in terms of things to consider for next time. So in terms of key findings, on a single night in January 2017, we estimated that 3,600 individuals were experiencing homelessness, as HUD defines it. As you can see, we have about 1,600 individuals that were in shelter on that night, and we have around 2,000 individuals that were unsheltered. Now, for the sheltered part, that's something really that Sacramento Steps Forward was in charge of. This data was derived from looking at HMIS data, and we were really responsible just for the unsheltered count. We weren't really involved in the logistics of the point in time count. That's something that Sacramento Steps Forward was involved in. We're more in the analytics part of it. And that was a really great, actually, collaboration, I think. We could have done the whole process, but the team that Sacramento Steps Forward had working on it really made things really smooth for us. One of the things that that kind of stands out on these findings is really the substantial increase in the unsheltered count. You can see that it almost doubled from 2015. Overall, this led to a 38% increase in the estimates. But we actually think that this is partly an inflated number. Of course, the point in time count is, it's treated as a census by HUD, as though we're collecting information on all individuals. I don't think that's exactly true, right? This is an estimate. And so it's undercounting, obviously, some groups. We'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. But it's supposed to be a kind of relative measure over time. So it's supposed to give you an idea if homelessness is increasing or decreasing. But we actually think that this 38% is a bit inflated because we suspect that there were some issues with the 2015 count. We weren't involved in that methodology. But we think if we account for the changes that we did, you can put on the space bar, it's more like a 30% increase And so we did kind of an adjusted analysis using the 2015 data and suggested that there was a substantial increase. And it is dramatic, but it's not as large as 38%.
Do you want to ask a couple of questions?
I think it's good to ask if we go along.
Sure.
So you do not officially change the 2015 count.
No.
And so I think it's important for us to, we really hold the PIT numbers in our
right.
head and the increases in our elected bodies and all the bodies. So I do believe it adds confusion, although I know, you know, the nuance
right.
is important. So we will, at the county, we'll continue to use the official count and the official increase.
Sure. Absolutely.
And Patty and Aaron. What is the basis of your suspect in undercounting 2015? There must be something that told you.
Yeah. Well, we talked about the methodology. I can kind of talk about the adjustment that we did. But basically, we ended up creating new maps, new zones to send people, in part because the data that we were looking at was misaligned with some of those zones that were sent out in 2015. But the biggest issue we saw is that certain parts of the southern part of the county weren't really covered sufficiently, and that's something that we added in 2017. And we estimated that about 15% of our estimate comes from the south part of the county. Mm-hmm. So that's really where the adjustment comes in.
But would it have come there in 15? Maybe it was an actual change from 15 to 17. Maybe folks weren't there in that 15% number. So how do you know that? Yes, it wasn't as represented, but that was based on the methodology of what folks knew where people were.
Yes, we did. As far as we saw, they didn't send any teams to a certain
okay,
south
so
part.
Teams.
So I have a hard
okay.
time thinking
zero.
That there's nobody
okay.
there. Yeah,
and our intelligence on where people are located is much better in this count. In 2015, we had no outreach, so we had no street-level partnership with law enforcement and other agencies doing outreach. And in this count, we had for a year and a half.
It's just really tricky to go back. I'm just thinking it gets really confusing. And I think it's tricky to go back and say, oh, we could have done it different.
Can I ask a question?
Aaron, I'm trying to line you up
that's
in
okay.
order.
Yeah.
Aaron
yeah.
and Amani and Emily.
So my question really is, you said that you relied on HMIS data for the shelter beds, and it seems to be a decrease in shelter beds over time. Is that a legit decrease in shelter beds or utilization, or what is that?
I want to come back to answer that. Our HMIS department was the lead, but we do see small fluctuations over time. But
it's kind of not small.
Exactly.
It's 150
so,
beds from 13 to 17.
Yeah. So I don't okay. need to get the exact answer to that question for you.
There could be pilgrimage, because that's 150 and it's only open some nights.
That's
possible.
Yeah,
that is
a possibility.
Okay,
thank you.
That was my question.
I just want to make a statement that whether it's 38% or 30% increase, it's still a very significant increase. I mean, we still have to keep that in mind, that it's a third growth. Yeah. So I just wanted to, if we're just fighting over 8%.
Yeah, I'm not trying to assert like what the real numbers are not. As researchers, we thought it'd be useful for you to consider what we think is a true relative measure, but we're not advocating that you change HUD numbers or anything like that.
Well, and that brings us back to Cindy's observation. I think it's extremely confusing to have a correction in a document. Every year the homeless count has deficits that affect one thing or another. Like, for instance, this year the family count was more of an undercount than previously, and we know the reasons why. So I just think it's not valid to change existing fully reported numbers, even if we know them to be somewhat subject to improvement by this year's methodology. You know, you can asterisk it all you want, but it's not okay to change the numbers, I think, especially in this particular area where many, many people rely on this data.
Can I ask
a
follow-up question?
Yeah.
Is it possible to get I don't even know if I want to say this, but some kind of a list that shows where the shelter numbers came from?
Yes, the shelter numbers come from the housing inventory, and it's a very robust list of housing information. And we certainly share that.
Somehow positive that all the homes and programs are actually represented in that. Right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, the CATC numbers are not represented in that. That could be up to another 120 beds. Mm-hmm. So, just be interesting to see it and then maybe have an opportunity to give some feedback that you would consider for addition or subtract.
Jonathan?
Yeah, it feels to me like we should not just look at the raw number of beds, but we should look at their occupancy. Mm-hmm. So even if there's a fluctuation in the number of beds, we're looking at what percent occupancy we have.
And so
that we have a metric that is stable across
the country. I'm with occupancy, but what I'm saying is even the occupancy. I'm sure there are other programs like this, the one that comes to my mind is CATC. Mm-hmm. So whether it's one person in the bed or 120, it's not represented on the housing.
Yeah.
And that the inventory report I'm talking about, it does include the number of beds and the utilization of the night of. So I can share that with folks.
And the other thing, I mean, this is from a your dissertation defense perspective, this is a major threat to validity if you're looking at us sampling differently for this study versus previous. Do you feel, and you're probably going to address this in your mapping, but if you feel like the sampling strategy that you came up with will be effective across time. Like, we'll penetrate all of our communities. It's clear that we've not done that before.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question because with something like the point in time study, it's supposed to capture trends. And so there's this tension between improving the accuracy and methodology and kind of preserving consistency over time, right? So you can make these comparisons. But as a independent researcher, I will tell you that the methodology needed to be improved. I didn't want to improve it. I had 2 weeks to do something, and I kind of told Sacramento Steps Forward, this isn't enough time for researchers to come in and reinvent things. We're going to do exactly what the 2015 researchers did. But I couldn't in good conscience do that, right? And so, I mean, you guys wanted to work with Sacramento Steps Forward, or I'm sorry, Sacramento State, we had to make a decision. And we made a decision that let's improve the methodology because what we're seeing is not lining up with the data that we're receiving from Sacramento Steps Forward.
Yeah. I mean, these are real world problems. It would just be nice to have, nothing he's saying is just to be surprising to any of us. So can we just continue to notate that? What changes in methodology there were at 2017 and then what changes at 18? I think it gives us at least a little bit of context for the information.
So let's keep going. I think we'll just skip over the demographics for right now. I think the kind of sobering increases that we find, and these are the unadjusted numbers, is increases in the number of individuals that were designated as chronically homeless increased substantially. We see that in 2015, we had 153 individuals that were in shelter. In 2017, that doubled, right? 323, and then for the unsheltered count, we had 313, and that went up to 103. So that's a 31% increase, and it's an increase both in the shelter and the unsheltered count. We also saw kind of a disturbing trend in terms of veterans. We saw a slight decrease in terms of the sheltered count, but we saw a pretty dramatic increase in the unsheltered count in terms of veteran homeless.
So just to correct you, it's not a 31% increase. It's chronically homeless count for 31% of homeless, right? Because the increase is greater than 31% for 313 to 803.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Thank you.
We saw decreases in transitional age youth and decreases in families with children. About a 20% decrease for Tay and about an 18% decrease for families with children. And in the report, we kind of spell out reasons why we think that this is an undercount. This is a systematic undercount. We think that transitional age youth, and HUD knows this, is a difficult group to capture. Same thing with families. And we'll talk a little bit about methodology. We have some suggestions about how we could look at this differently, but we think that the point in time is always going to systematically undercount families. But just looking at trends over time, it is interesting that the sheltered count of families decreased all 3 years, right? And we had very small unsheltered families that we found in 2017, but that was also the case in 2015 and 2013. And so generally what we find is that 95 to 97% of families are in shelters at the time of the count, at least as PIT data, and that's pretty consistent with other communities find as well. And the decreases seen in shelter count kind of suggest that there is a general decrease, at least within this segment of families that are experiencing homelessness.
Emily? So I think this is, maybe not for the SAC stakeholders, but as this is a really important thing to communicate, because the decrease in family is almost entirely in the shelter count. We know we did not close shelter beds. So this is a direct result of how things are classified in the HIC or not classified in the HIC. And I think the message this sends to the public is really, really concerning, because we didn't close any family shelter beds. We just called things different. And I think that, I don't think that's on sexy. I think that we as a community need to explain that, because this is going to cause more.
Is that the St. John's
bed? I'm guessing that's what it is.
That's the contributing factor. I was just going to say there's a set of explanations that go alongside the count that we submit to HUD, and St. John's is in that, and the complete explanation of any reductions can be found there. So let me bring that out to see what it looks like for this group.
Right. Can I also remind you all that we started the closure of the Mather family sign in 2000.
Yeah, there are a number of small, it may have been smaller across for each one, but collectively.
Okay. I just think it's going to be alarming.
But wouldn't shelter include both transitional and shelter? So no, just shelter beds? Doesn't include transitional beds?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the fact that they switched would not explain it. I did have a question, though. What is the general reason you mentioned that it would be systematically undercounted, either Tay or children, families?
So in terms of families, the research literature suggests that families who are experiencing housing insecurity usually will stay in cars or shelters. And the car issue is tricky for us because surveyors are trained not to knock on cars and to see who the individuals are in those cars. So we don't really have good survey data of people on those cars. And I would suspect that most of the cars and tents that we encounter that we don't have data on were families. Right, and so because we don't do this, this systematically affects all of the counts.
So you think families are hidden in cars or in tents?
Yeah, less likely to be encountered just walking around in the street.
I don't know if that seems the case, and I'm looking at folks like Joan, but it's worth looking at. I mean, I know we undercount couch surfing. I know that, but that's not in the HUD definition. So I'm a little wondering on that.
You know, I can say for downtown, I never see families, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. I know they exist because we do house them, but we typically do find them in cars or in shelters. So that rings true, at least for my little neck of the world. So.
And another difference this past January was previously we did a morning after count at Mustard Seed, Mary House, and Women's Empowerment programs that we knew serve unsheltered families. And the total numbers are so small that missing those few, families would really skew it. And at Mustard Seed, for instance, they've had a huge change in population this year. Previously, most of the children at Mustard Seed were sheltered. And this year, most are unsheltered at the point of first contact. And then DHA has been extraordinarily responsive in putting them in motels, but there are many more unsheltered families in Mustard Seed.
The motels rings true. That's where they are. I mean, I know there are other places.
And then they're
I
not
get
in
it,
shelter.
But they are. Yeah. Yeah, but they are in motels. And perhaps was motels counted?
No.
That's where
so
they're
that
at. Yeah.
Motels.
And there are a lot of home
lot more people sleeping in cars. There just are.
Yeah.
We get calls on a regular basis from Loaves and Fishes saying,
no,
13 cars lined up out there with cameras.
Yeah, we'll have to look at the...
And they're hidden. I mean,
right,
more so than more signals.
We'll have to look at the methodology for the next count around this issue. Mm-hmm. And the challenge I know that we struggle with is, so we count a car, a vehicle, and then there is an assumed two or three that are counted for that vehicle.
That's right.
Per the guidelines. And then the next morning, and if we were able to do an interview with the person that we meet on the street or family, then there's a unique identifier that's created out of that interview, so that when we see them the next morning at one of the designated points, then you're not getting a duplicate count. But if you count all the cars and tents and make the assumption that there's many families in those cars and tents, when you go to count in the morning at another location, that family came out of the car, there's no unique identifier, they come to your presence, you do a second interview, you've now duplicated a count. So I'm not saying it shouldn't happen, but it's a methodology that we need to look at so that we reduce the likelihood of having a duplicate count.
Yeah, it's interesting. We actually got a call about a week ago from another university who read the report, and they kind of have told us this is an issue that they're struggling with as well, and they suggested a couple of different methodologies. They're separate from the PIT, and we can talk a little bit about what those methodologies are.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Jonathan? Yeah, I guess we've seen a lot more families in tents. That's anecdotal, but we... even reinforce that cycle. We've seen more that. I just wonder if there is a way. I understand the confounds that Brian's bringing up, but like, could we, if we know that we've got a set of families that are getting certain benefits, like the no child vouchers or something, could we somehow kind of tick them off?
Yeah.
So that we're doing a pre-point in time for that group, and that we're really doing a street-based.
But I think there's, and I think there's methodology that we, as a local continuum, should use to get our, what we know to be true about the population, less than what happens at a single point in time.
But that strategy, just like the other strategy we're talking about prior to this, it needs more than a couple of weeks. We need to get DHA involved with whoever, just so that we can get the data from them, so we can.
That's fine. I'll go.
So, if a family receives a motel voucher, are they not part of HMIS? I mean, don't they have to be in HMIS to the county?
I would say that the year-round county motel voucher doesn't die in HMIS.
You're using the money. And so to help people who are out on the streets. And so, this is a bigger, more complex issue.
I'll just share with the group that for shelter programs that are not participating in HMIS, we'll make an effort every year to engage as many of those as possible in reporting just their one night so they can be included. So, for example, if Francis House has any families in motels on count night, those get counted. But some of these others that Carolyn's mentioning may or may not be aware of them, or they sometimes have vouchers, sometimes don't. So we do have a backup methodology for the non-HMIS programs, but it's not like that.
David?
But then
if we start
changing the methodology, then the maps kind of change and the definitions change over time, then how do we go back then and compare last year, this year, because we're not comparing the same numbers, so that's when you're looking at, well, why is it different? Well, because last year we counted, I remember a point in time count way back when we were like instructed if someone was walking after midnight in the area that you were in, and they looked like whatever. I mean, it could have gone out of a BMW and with their husband going from dinner, but you counted them because they were. And I was like, these were. Yeah. So So that's just my question, is if you keep changing this, and how do you go back and compare it to the year before?
Yeah, no, I think
agree
that's great.
The training on how to count has changed over the years.
Yeah, so that's just my worry, is that maybe the numbers are all the same, but this is the way we're doing
it. And it's volunteers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I these are great questions, and there was even an article in the New York Times on Monday talking precisely about this issue, about how continuums are all experiencing changes in methodology, and so is it a real increase or not increase? And there was a study done out by Cornell that looked at precisely at this issue, and there's no easy answers, right? That's, again, why we did the adjusted 2015, because we do think that there is a rise in homelessness. I mean, I think people feel that. You talk to different community members. I mean, I think that there is a substantial rise of 30%. I don't think that 38%, I know that's like minor issue, but I don't think that that's a real real increase, but there is no easy answer to your issue.
And the study from Cornell estimated that of the 25 largest metropolitan areas in the United States, and I don't think SAC is in there.
That, no.
But it said that the counts were an undercount by 25%. You know, so there's significant ways to improve. And I don't think, I mean, we want apples to apples, but it's better to get an accurate count. So if we're moving in the direction of an accurate count, even if it distorts things, that's still obviously what we want to do.
Yeah, and, you know, just adding another area, I mean, I'd be interested in seeing the homeless among the veteran population. If you add South Sacramento to your sampling area, you're going to see veterans. I mean, there's a bunch of them down there who don't come up into the urban core. And in the down around Florin, there's a big veteran population.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know if that map.
So we actually, on that note, a number of the things that we did within the sort of evaluation of the data that wasn't included in this, we sort of noted it a couple of times sort of briefly, was that we actually looked at correlations between different subpopulations, where they were found, how many people were found in those households, things of that nature. And we found that, like, pretty significantly, veterans are more likely to be older males living outside. So exactly what you said, that these individuals were by themselves, they were outside of the city limits, and I think it's very much the expansion of the mapping areas into these sort of unincorporated areas in the Northeast and further outside of the Midtown area in the South caught a lot of those populations. So there you said, statistically, by the numbers we found that, yes, if you're found outside, you're more likely to be old white male veteran than pretty much any other population group.
Yeah. Just one more question. Did you do much in terms of validating and verifying that these were veterans? What did your team do?
There were basically three questions that HUD wants us to ask individuals, whether or not they've received services from the VA, an outright question if they've ever served in the armed forces, and then I think the question if they've worked for the National Guard, or they've been in the National Guard. And if they answer one to any of those, they're considered a veteran. Now, of course, that's all self-reported. And so that probably does factor into it as well.
Yeah, just to tell you, for me, my name's Dr. Yannick. I lead homeless primary care. Typically on Wednesdays, I'm out at Sacramento PD looking for homeless veterans along the river and places in downtown. And you'll forgive the cynicism, but the biggest dent that I made in terms of the homeless veteran population with the impact team that the Sacramento PD directs towards this initiative is identifying those folks who aren't veterans and saying they are.
Right.
John?
The other population that surprised me was this reduction in transition age youth. Did you have some thoughts about what that's about?
Yeah, I mean, I think you brought up the couch surfing issue, you know.
But that would be every year. Why
this?
And there were extra efforts made this year to do something.
There were.
Transition age youth.
Yeah.
There were. Say what?
I was just going to say anecdotally.
Sure, anecdotal is fine. Well, I mean, this is a tricky issue to answer, but yeah.
So when we had our first debrief with a lot of the members here, we spoke with some of the Haiti volunteers that we had, there was some talk about, you know, well, if the group seemed uncomfortable or didn't want to answer some of the questions, we sort of, didn't ask questions of these individuals, right? So it seemed like, and this is something we brought up in the report, that part of our approach should be on the training side, right? Maybe getting social work students or people who had more, you know, experience with mental health services or something like that, do some of the training to sort of allow individuals. We've done some motivational interview training that I know SACMESTO coordinates as well. So to say, if you approach these, you know, tough population groups, right? Here's how to best interact with them. And I think, you know, looking at, as you can see with the confidence intervals we have, there's actually a chance that there wasn't any change from 2015 to 2017, just based on, what we can say we're sure of in the data, right? But that's certainly something we can improve upon.
What Keith is highlighting is that, you know, this year Sacramento Steps Forward worked with different organizations to get actual transitional age youth to help locate spots and as well as interview. But there were some survey quality issues that we encountered, specifically with the surveys that were done with transitional age youth. And one of the recommendations we put forth in the report is, you know, for surveys, we would recommend maybe having a designated person who does the survey that we can provide extra training to make sure that those surveys are done consistently. Even though this is a volunteer-based project, I think on that side of it, that would improve estimates. There was a decline, but as Keith says, we have these confidence intervals that we did basically to highlight that there's a chance that there might have not actually been a change, just given the variance in our level of confidence in the range of scores that could have been possible. I'm trying to like explain statistical significance without like being all detailed.
How does the survey affect the count? Because you don't know their age, you don't count them in that group. How does the fact that surveying may not be?
So the survey data, and we'll get to this in a second actually, we weight the survey data to the count data to estimate the demographics of the count. So, you know, volunteers are given a count form and they're given surveys, and basically what we do is match those up, where each survey is giving a statistical weight based on where the survey was done and then the size of the household. And so if we don't have good surveys of families sleeping in cars and we don't have good surveys of transitional age youth, we're less confident in those estimates for those specific demographic groups.
There was some sound in my know-it-all. AB12 did go into effect in this time period, and I think there is a real legitimate possibility that the transition age youth count did decrease, because what AB12 did is allow you to stay, if they were in foster homes, up to the age of 21 instead of having to leave at the age of 18. And I think that's very significant and maybe could be considered in this process. It's not always methodology.
That's the point.
And I don't know how you're gathering all of that kind of systemic environmental information. If you have focus groups that you're working with each of these populations, but it would be useful, I think, to have that information.
That's a good point.
Jason. So I kind of wanted to go back to the better things really quickly, because I think there is some important consideration that we should make when looking at these numbers. Like the fact that our unsheltered homeless veteran numbers are going up is not really that surprising. You think about, and sure there are plenty of people who claim to be veterans who are not, but, you know, we've been at war for 17 years. We're continually creating homeless veterans every day. Our men and women get out, and it takes oftentimes several years before the consequences of before their life start breaking down, and we're starting to see that now. You know, our programs have seen a lot more of the 23 to 34, 35 age range of people who are now homeless and families are falling apart. So this number is important, I think, for us to look at. You know, it's not as easy as saying we need to build more housing to say for any of our homeless population. This is going to continue to happen. I think it's important for us to start thinking about how to address it.
One of the things that we highlight were four contextual factors that we highlight in the report that we think affected the count. One is, as we all know, there was severe weather and flooding right before the count, and we think, we assume that that affected maybe the veteran issue, also older individuals that might have been living upstream up in the riverbed that moved down. Volunteers counted three times more tents in 2017 than it did in 2015, which I think that just speaks to this kind of displaced population. We think it's also important to highlight that there's growth in homelessness throughout the state. Now the PITs are coming out in terms of individual reports, but the reports that we've looked at, we've seen increases in LA, Alameda County, Butte County, and although the rates vary from 23% to as high as 70%, it seems like there's a general increase in homelessness overall. Probably not surprising to anybody in this room is that the housing market plays a big factor into it, and that's what the Cornell study is probably is using to estimate the real homelessness, is looking at the percentage of residents that spend more than 30% of their income on rent or mortgage. That's really high here in Sacramento, and that index is basically used to estimate homelessness because it's seen as a really strong predictor of the rate of homelessness. And then improved methodology, which we'll discuss now. Yes?
The term flooding, I mean, in a lot of areas we're seeing on TV now where like whole neighborhoods are being flooded and whatever, we kind of, since you do share these reports, mm-hmm. the term flooding, I think, you know, we consider it flooding. It was really high river levels. And we all understand what was going on, but if this goes outside, it looks like neighborhoods were flooded and people were flooded out of their homes, which may have impacted versus our situation, which was high river levels, so people weren't in some of their normal places.
You mean people were camping on the floodplain and had to move off of it, and then they were more visible.
Right, exactly.
I mean, we understand that in this room, but when you put flooding up there and you share it in other parts of the country, they may interpret that differently.
Fair enough. All right, methodology. I think I'll do a brief version of this. So there's really kind of four components, or how I think about the methodology, there's really four components. The first component is really gathering what we call mapping, is Sacramento Steps Forward doing this outreach before the count and working with different stakeholders and service providers. I think there are about 38 that you guys worked with, and provide us kind of geolocations of where people have seen people sleep. And we had about 1,000 locations that we were provided with. And we overlaid that with the previous maps that the 2015 research team used. And we try to see, do the maps align with the outreach data that we got? And this year, that data was provided pretty close to the actual count, right? On my side, it's a nightmare to be provided this information 2 weeks before. But we actually think that's better because it's likely that if you're provided that data months ahead, it's going to be outdated by the time.
And it would have been provided and the water levels would not have risen.
Right.
And so the majority of our population along those waterways would have been negligible.
The second component then is deciding, we have these zones, we have the outreach data. Which one of these zones are likely areas to find homeless, which one of these zones are somewhat likely and which zones are unlikely. And basically doing a sampling based on what we call hot zones, warm zones, and cold zones. Then there is the actual counting of the surveys, the enumeration forms and the surveys themselves. We'll talk a little bit about some of the revisions that we did this year. And then there's the kind of data cleaning and analysis. So let's go ahead and just skip maybe to the next slide just to. So our goal, like I said before, was to use all 80 zones that the previous researchers had developed. But when we looked at the 2017 data and the 2015 zones, we noticed a misalignment. Now, some zones were in flooded areas or were areas where you couldn't reach or accessible. But some zones just weren't, the data didn't match up, right? We could have sent people there, but it's unlikely that we would have encountered individuals. And so we kind of made a decision, really, you know, 10 days before the count, to start developing new zones. And we ended up creating we ended up creating a total of 104 new zones, and amending some of the 2015 zones. Combined, we had 145 zones that we could have sent to teams to on the night of the count. And here are the 145 zones. Some of them throughout, not all of them, yeah, throughout Sacramento. Let's keep going. In terms of the sampling strategy, we automatically sampled all of the hot zones, all zones that we designated that were likely. We had 119 warm zones, and what we did next was there were certain priority areas that Sacramento Subsort had helped us identify that we said if there's a warm zone within this region, it automatically gets sampled. And then for the rest, we randomly sampled 17 zones. And so in total, we prepared 80 mapping packets for Sacramento Steps 4 to distribute to volunteers on the night of the round. When we we were actually kind of attending the training sessions that Sacramento Steps 4 was doing with volunteers. And one of the things that we heard from volunteers was that they really didn't like the maps of the previous years, and sometimes they weren't given a whole lot of information. So we actually spent a lot of time creating new maps with directions and arrows and stuff like that. And all of this was done, like I said, you know, a week before the count. So we had a nice assembly line of students at Sac State producing these maps at a very fast rate. It's a nice thing about working with the university. Oh, great, great. Students would be happy to know.
It sounds like you created a lot more zones compared to prior counts, and that you adjusted some of the previous zones.
That's right.
Do you have any zones that were not adjusted that you still counted that you could look and see? These are kind of the legacy zones that were identical, and would it be worth looking and seeing if there were changes just within those?
Yes, that's a great question. And so we had about 44 zones, I believe, that were
25 that weren't changed.
25, and then there's like 20 that were slightly changed. And we did look at the changes within those zones, correct?
So, I mean, we have a database where that analysis was done, but it wasn't included in the actual report.
Okay. Yeah. I remember thinking exactly that you're thinking along the same lines.
It's like the only place where you've got the same
That's right. And I want to say we did notice a change in those zones as well. Our zones generally had a higher average of people found than compared to the 2015. I can say that for certain. Yeah.
Just a recommendation for next time, to the extent that CSUS is involved or there's some ongoing involvement rather than, you know, waiting to, or just a 2-month thing, is that I noticed that it looks like you sought information from the sheriff on calls for service. I don't think that same request was made of the city 311 or of city police, but I do know that we have historical data going back from our 311 and our police department for probably now 2 years on calls for service.
That's
so it
great.
Seems like, to Jonathan's point, you could almost, with the sheriff's information that you asked for the cities as well, we could sort of provide ongoing information about where we get reports, either through 311 or through police calls, and it wouldn't be so much work jammed into a month or so.
That would be great.
And we can probably produce it over time. So.
And Emily, we did reach out to SACPD.
Yeah, but not 311, I think, is the...
Well,
But
we reached out to the city of Sacramento. So
no, I'm not suggesting
you
reach out to the city.
Disposal,
I'm just saying that the total life history of calls to service. Yeah.
But that's great. More data, better.
Last point on the slide, of the 80 zones you were saying. Is that a theoretically desirable number? Is that constrained by the enumeration of resources that could be attracted?
That's right. We assume that Sacramento Steps Forward have about 360 to 400 volunteers. I think they ended up having like 320, 350. And so we thought, you know, at most 80 zones could be deployed. We've done some additional analysis, and absolutely, if we had the more resources, I think going for more like 110 zones would be the ideal number. But just the logistics of that is a little bit complicated.
Yeah. On your map, the previous slide, the color coding, it doesn't look like it's districts. What is the key to the color coding of yellow, blue, red, you know, zones? Is there a key code about what that is about?
Yeah.
So there's a couple of different ways of trying to extrapolate data, right? And so one of them is you want to see what is the sort of most valid base information that you have in your sample group and in the group you're trying to sample to, right? And so there is very little amount of actual information in the enumeration form, in the actual count form. It's basically, how many people do you see, what's their general age, et cetera, et cetera.
So I'm going to pause you just for a second, because it's going to get technical. The answer is basically is that in our extrapolation, we noticed that there's some consistencies that are clustered. And we basically identified five areas where the data is kind of harmonious in a sense. And that data was useful for us when we did the weighting. So that's the answer.
Well, I'm just trying to, on that chart right here, it's not districts. What is this yellow, purple, red signifying? It's basically my question.
Yeah, basically the way that we weighted the data, we noticed that these zones were somewhat similar in terms of the numbers that were found.
So only similarities.
Similarities, okay. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that was my question. So look regional, look almost district.
Right.
And that, with no answer, what was defining that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll ask for it later.
Oh, great. And Keith has much more technical detail if you want to.
Okay.
He's quite good at that.
So I'm pressing the buttons.
I'm going to pause you right there. In terms of the survey, we did a couple revisions. We noticed that there were a lot of skip patterns used in the previous surveys in terms of, like, if they answer this, go to this question, go to this question. There was about, I think, 9 to 10 pages long, and so we tried to simplify things, and we just actually went to the HUD website, and we found that they actually had, like, a template that they suggested, and we basically revised the survey to follow their template, which makes it simpler and is actually a shorter survey than what was conducted in 2015. We had all the questions of 2015 in there, but just organized slightly different. Same thing with the enumeration forms. We added this transgender question that HUD wanted to be asked this year, that was different. And so, as I said, on the night of the count, volunteers were in teams of four, they were deployed, they were given a packet, they were told to visually count individuals with the count form, and then conduct surveys with individuals that were willing and able to do so. And so we collected about 450 completed count forms, which translates to about 1,400 households, and then we had 168 surveys. Now, on the count forms, HUD likes to see information in terms of people being in groups and households, and so volunteers were instructed that if there were people that they thought were together to circle, like, observations together, and that information gave us the household size, which was really useful for us for our extrapolation method. So we had lots of forms, and so we had these volunteer pizza nights at Sac State. We had lots of students come out and enter the data. We've actually had them enter the data twice to catch for inconsistencies, and then we cleaned the data in terms of consistency through questions, dealing with missing data. Now, the one thing that we did differently here that wasn't done before is that, you know, the count data has some demographic questions, but it's not very good. I mean, there's a lot of missing data when people, and they're also just guessing, right? I think that this person is this old. I think that this person is of this racial group, right? And so HUD recommends that you do surveys to then weight to the count data. And in previous years, what we can tell is that you had basically, you know, what it sounds like they did to me is that if 75% of your survey respondents are male, then 75% of your count data are males, right? The problem with that is you're making a lot of assumptions about how males are distributed across the city. And so what we did is that we matched, because we had information about where the count was done and the household size. And so what we did is that we matched basically where the survey was taken to where the counts were done, and then the household size. And so each survey is given a specific statistical weight, which is what HUD recommends you that you do. It gives you a more accurate extrapolation of demographics from the count data.
Yeah. Question. So it's great that HUD did add a question about gender identity, but how was that question asked, and how were the volunteers trained to ask that question? Because there's so much sensitivity around that.
I can't, top of my head, remember the wording of the question.
It was literally just like, are you count as male, female, transgender, or other? Was it four gender options?
Yeah. I'm not going to say it was the best method.
There you go. Yeah, that's not. Okay. But there were no questions. So there were questions on ethnicity, on the gender identity, but there were no questions on sexual orientation.
No.
Okay.
I noticed you also did not include here the data which people look at a lot, which is identifying as having a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue or other kinds of things. Can you say something? Because we do look at that. I think we don't know how to use that,
sure,
that data.
So, yeah, we do, in the report, we do specify, actually, I'm not sure we do specify.
Yeah.
We do. In certain sections of the report, we talk about the rate of individuals who reported a traumatic brain injury, PTSD, depression. So all those questions were asked, and we do highlight it in parts of the report. We didn't highlight it in the presentation today just because, thank you. He has specific data points for that, but we didn't highlight it in the presentation just because of time today.
Because it actually is, those kinds of questions tell us a lot. I love hearing about your methodology a little bit, but I would like to know what you,
sure,
feel about the characteristics of the people besides the numbers.
Right.
We have it broken down by chronically homeless, veteran homeless, and general population to compare, and we have mental disability, physical disability, drug and alcohol abuse, and chronicity. And it is, just looking at it right now, I'm looking at it previously. The one biggest question is like drug and alcohol abuse, because again, self-identified, it's pretty much consistent around all the minor demographics. But you definitely see like PTSD within veteran groups, for instance, is something like 20% higher than the general population. You see the same thing in chronicity, higher percentages of people with mental and physical disabilities. So yeah, all of those are certainly broken down within the report.
Yeah, and I did see that. I was just interested in what you thought it told us, other than what we can read.
Yeah, no, fair point.
Let me pose a specific version of Cindy's question.
Sure.
Figure 9, which is comparing conditions of chronically homeless versus all unsheltered homeless, reports drug use, mental health, mental conditions, PTSD. They're virtually identical, except for if you've been homeless a long time. There's a gigantic difference between those two populations. The inference is there's something else that's not one of these nameable conditions that explains why you're chronically homeless versus just homeless.
Right.
And that is an explanation that was just begging for further research or even guesses as to what that causes, because that may be fundamental to trying to approach, connect to, and treat those people.
Right. I think you're asking kind of like what's the lesson point from, or what's our perspective on it? I hate just kind of citing numbers that I don't have in front of me, but I would say that we found 40% of the homeless individuals that were interviewed indicated some kind of mental illness or disability. I don't think that means that that clearly says not the majority of individuals who are homeless have a mental health issue, but it is a large percentage.
Or disability, mental illness or disability, 40%, or just mental illness?
I would say mental illness or disability.
Because disability includes everything.
Right.
So that really doesn't...
So there's about 7 different questions that they ask about different disabilities. So it says, like, Have you ever had a traumatic brain injury? Have you ever suffered PTSD? Have you had a mental disability? Have you had a physical disability? And then it asks, have any, you know, for each of those disabilities, it asks, has this disability kept you from finding a job? And it also asks, have you ever had disability benefits, right? So there are six, I believe, different questions that are all focused on this one topic. And so while we broke them down individually within the sort of data collection effort, for this, what we do is basically said, okay, given a specific household, specific individual, they may have answered, you know, four or five of the questions. We basically tried to say, okay, this person is within the category of physical disability. This person is within the category of mental disability. So one of the things you see with the chronicity is that there's not, as you said, as much difference between the chronic homeless and general population, but there is those differences in combinations, right? So the general population may still have this drug abuse issue, but as you said, they're not on the street as long as the chronically homeless individuals. And one of the things we bring up that some PIDs do is ask specific questions about how have you become homeless. And I think that's, as you sort of alluded to, an important question, because then we can break out, especially with the housing issue, right? Like, was it just that you had an apartment 2 months ago and your rent increased by 30% and now all of a sudden you find yourself on the street versus you've been, you know, living in Sacramento for 10 years and just sort of found a, weird to say niche, but, you know, this is sort of the lifestyle of this individual now, whatever the case may be.
So I have this question for, I think, SSF, but has the gaps analysis that was done been provided for comparison against the
Yeah.
So
the PIT, the PIT data, this PIT data, is included in the gaps analysis, which will primarily show us the gaps on the housing intervention side of that equation. I think some of the gaps analysis that's desired by folks in this room is on the side of population.
That's what I was thinking we had. I was thinking we had gaps analysis that was going to be compared to the so that we could see if there was congruency or consistency between the populations that are unsheltered and the gaps that we have in our system.
Well, there is HMIS data,
right,
which you can compare.
But there was a whole gaps analysis project done. Right.
Well, it's based on HMIS. I mean, where the data is related to these questions is in
HMIS.
2017,
all of that's been pulled into that analysis.
So I'm just going to leave that question on the table. I think that would be very valuable information to use against, and help us understand incongruencies, congruency, understand that.
Right. And I think like your question, her question earlier. Exactly. Let's go to the recommendation slide. Let's go to the very end. So challenges and lessons learned for 2017. I think we did discuss this a little bit before. Time constraints versus timely data. I think even though I didn't like working in this speed, I think it was you should probably do that again. You know, survey inconsistencies. We talked a little bit about that. You know, people were filling these surveys out in the dark. This is paper surveys, and we have some recommendations on that. We did have a lower response rate than in 2015. We had 168 surveys to work with, and in 2015 they had 227 surveys. And so we would have liked to see something like north of 250 surveys, to be honest with you. And then, like we spoke a little bit about already, is the undercounting of TAE. In terms of successes, at least from our perspective, this collaboration with Sacramento Steps Forward, where they did lots of the logistics on the ground stuff, was great. Because they had a really good team that communicated well. We had more efficient mapping or accounting, and it comes to that issue that was raised earlier. On average, the zones in 2015 yielded about 12 individuals counted, and this year it was around 28.5. And so there's a higher number on average that the zones yielded. So that makes us believe that this is actual substantial count. There is a high amount of variance. There's a lot of diversity in those numbers, in part because we counted areas that had lots of tents and cars. And per HUD guidelines, every time we saw a tent, we estimated that there were three people inside that tent. So that increases the estimate substantially.
I think that, 2 years ago, wasn't that a lower multiplier?
I think so.
And was that directed by, I don't remember if that was a HUD thing or a local thing? Because it was definitely a lower multiplier, like 1.7-ish?
Yeah, we ended up talking with Michelle, and I know she reached out to other continuums asking about what multiplier do they use, and so we just kind of used the standard that we heard that other folks were using.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it wasn't a HUD thing saying it should be 3 in every 10?
No, I mean, they have a, on the HUD guidelines, there's something about weighting of tents, but they don't give a specific number.
Okay.
And so that's when we started connecting with other folks.
Okay.
Recommendations, we strongly suggest using kind of some kind of mobile app technology next time instead of paper surveys. HUD actually provides an open source survey tool that we could have used. But I did not want to use that a week before the count. You know, technology fails just like this clicker fails, and so I would want to do field testing prior to actually doing it. But I think that would be really, it would make collecting the data much easier. It would also save us time and resources having to input that data and deal with consistencies.
Sure, would you recommend that so that we try to prevent the clicker not working, that we practice with this tool in a trial run on a smaller subset of populations, something like that?
Absolutely. There's lots of logistic issues to work out, and I think there's different ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. You can get an independent vendor to like handle that. Sac State could develop, we do surveys already,
yeah.
We could do something like that, or we could use the HUD, but absolutely field test it on a night with a small.
I'm going to also put in our wish list of the 550,000 that some would be allocated for that, that purpose. And we can bring it back to discussions like that.
Can I just bring you up?
Sure.
Todd, right? So we're working with the HOT team with the county, and we're actually, or your guys are actually working with a third-party vendor to make a mobile app for our survey program with the homeless individuals that they interact with.
Yep.
So I think that would be probably a great place to start since we're sort of already building that tool for us now.
And talk, is that on the SPI grant, or is that what's just the hot key?
Yeah.
We can talk offline, but yeah, let's do it.
Second recommendation that we have is for designating an individual in each team to do the surveys. I think doing surveys with a vulnerable population is already difficult, and if you haven't been trained in doing surveys, it can be kind of an awkward experience, right? And, you know, we train surveys that you have to just go through the awkwardness and not stop midstream in terms of your questions. And so we highly recommend you making that person either maybe a social worker from the county or using some MSW students from Sac State. We have one of the largest social work programs in the country, over 220 graduate students who would be happy to help volunteer to do this kind of thing. And we could provide extended trainings for that. There is the volunteer training, but we could spend, you know, 3 months training the interviewers to do the surveys as accurately as possible.
With respect to that particular point, many of those social work students are already interning with many of our agencies. They're already motivational interview trained, so we should collaborate on that. We should offer up all of our interns, at least make it available for them. We can save ourselves a lot of trouble if we did that.
And I was going to say, I mean, even I'm sure other agencies too, but like at Weave, all our volunteers have to go through a 70-hour training, and a lot of it is around sensitivity and stuff. I think it would be a really good opportunity for volunteers who are already trained, and we have trouble utilizing them sometimes to do meaningful work, and I think this could be a great volunteer opportunity.
I have a related suggestion for a change, which is to have a larger group than just SSF directing and reviewing the methodology and design, to actually have a smaller group participate in that along the way. I know the county would be interested, I'm assuming the cities would be interested, and certainly representatives. I don't want a large group, but it seems like there are various perspectives that could enhance the design and the report itself. And so I don't know if you do that. I don't think there is
I like the idea. And what I want to have is, what we're bringing on board staffing-wise to help support, is to have this, what we call the data brain or analysis, that would do just that. So I'd have a broader cross-section of folks at the table that are systems and data-oriented, and then bring in somebody like a Sac State to join us for that, and that would be one of the functions.
And then in this particular thing, I think the perspective of people on the ground is key people on the, not every, you're all on the ground, but key, you know, just some representation in the design and carrying out the questions or.
The other thing that we're putting together is a curriculum for volunteer training. And so it makes sense to me to include this as part of that methodology, given that opportunity. So, and that's, we should be able to start getting that off in November.
We suggest some survey revisions. Some of the questions I think that would be useful that other PITs ask in other communities, one question is where people are from. I think there's a general perception that most homeless are from not from here, and I think whether that's true or not, that's up to debate. You know, the research literature suggests that that's not true, and that's just a common stereotype. But it would be great to have data on this issue. I know we have data on HMIS that captures that as well, but I think that would be a great question to capture in that. I think having some questions about asking the individuals what factors contributed to their homelessness. And we can talk about the specifics at some other point, but just generally gauging that. And also asking questions about sexual orientation, as you brought up earlier. I think designing that question a bit more specific. Of course, we have to ask the HUD mandated questions, but I think we could do a better job in asking other questions.
And gender identity. Is there a way that we can start, instead of saying LGBTQ status, calling it SOGI data? So it's... So it includes sexual orientation and gender identity, SOGI. That way everyone's included, and it doesn't seem like we're singling out the folks who are other.
Sure,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And in addition to the factors contributing, I think what would be really valuable is what do you need to leave homelessness? Like, instead of like the past, might have been 10 years ago. I actually heard people say in my surveys, I just need an ID, and I don't know how to do that. Now, maybe they need more, but what do they think they need?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In addition to why are they here?
Right.
I also wanted to ask here in the room, how many folks actually volunteered during the point in time this past year? Just wondering. Because I think that it would be really good if we could all commit to the next one so that we can bring... So that we have firsthand knowledge of what that felt like, and we can bring back that input, that feedback. I just, you know, just a suggestion.
I didn't see specifics, so I'm assuming you did come out with, as you describe, of like knowing down the south area unreported, probably knowing up around, should we say, the I-80 corridor or. Around SACSID itself, there's probably a large homeless, and defining those populations. Was there any recommendations of recognizing areas that you specifically identified specifically that weren't there or you didn't have before to areas you realize counts may be i.e. below Mather or, you know, i.e. below McClellan, i.e. under the freeways,
right.
You know, through there. Was any of that in this information possible, the survey?
We did kind of a heat map in the report using the location of the surveys. And if we use a mobile app, the surveys would be geolocated, so that would be useful.
Right.
But we, of course, are hesitant about like identifying specific spots where people are sleeping.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we have to be aware of that as well.
Yeah.
I don't want, you know, newspapers to create apps to show where people are sleeping and stuff like that. I think that would be problematic. Mm-hmm. But that's a great suggestion.
I just ask.
Yeah. I think finally, just in terms of ideas for improving, I think we talked a little bit about the challenge about tension between improving methodology versus need for consistency. And we can talk at some other point about engagement ideas. But I do think for the Tay and the family, you do need a different, almost separate study to look at that, you know. Like, and one thing that we're thinking about doing at Sac State, we're actually deploying a representative survey of residents in the county. And one of the questions we're asking is about couch surfing. And that data, I think, might be useful for this group to learn about. Another methodology, something that Keith and I have been thinking about, is what if we did a separate study where we trained specific volunteers to actually interview people in cars? And maybe that would give us a better estimate about who's sleeping in the car. I think the last point that I'll leave it, and that'll be it, thanks for being so patient, is I think It's really, it's been a great collaboration between Sacramento and Southport. We are an independent entity, right? And I do think that that's like a, that's an important point to highlight. Like Sacramento Steps Forward didn't really have any editorial review over the report. And that's great, I think, because this is a political issue. There's lots of political interest, but we have to report the data as it is, right? We're primarily researchers. And so we have, that's kind of what our basis is. And you want that to be established in these types of reports. And with that, that's our presentation.
Thank you.
I'm sure there's other questions. Yes.
When it comes to making sure that responses are as factual as possible, this whole issue of self-reporting, are you looking to go further? I mean, for me, literally, as an internal medicine doctor, I'm cautioned by my peers in mental health who tell me, don't make this diagnosis. You know, this takes significant screening. So when it comes to a lay person, kind of like saying, I have PTSD. For me, you know, when I hear that, it's like, okay, you know, are further, is this being followed up on? Is anything being done in that thing to make sure that the self-reporting is accurate on items that, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a great question you're asking. And, you know, is this a psychiatric epidemiological study? It's not, right? We don't have trained surveyors to ask about symptomology, which is what you would really need to do to get an accurate estimate of prevalence. What we are asking is if people are willing to disclose, has anybody ever said that you have PTSD? You know, and so it is not great data. If we had trained surveyors, that would be, or interviewers, that would be something to consider about asking about symptomology, not asking about a diagnosis, but asking about certain conditions. But that's, it's not what the PIT was necessarily designed to do, but there's no reason why we couldn't do that as a community.
And you clarify it's self-reported, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like they're very clear that it's a self-reported statistic.
Right, yeah.
John, that'll be our last question.
From the college, it's really, I think, better quality than maybe we've had before in training. I'm not sure what our role is as an advisory board. Could you clarify what our responsibility is about the planned time count and all that, or if we even have one exactly? Or is there a way to answer that?
Well, I think my intention is that the point time count would, given its misgivings and its positive, that would help inform the decision-making of this body. So ultimately, that's my goal as an outcome. But to also consider the methodology issues that have been brought to our attention and the practices, and the city made a good recommendation about how we might progress in the future, and it was mentioned that this should be maybe a year-round process of review.
I guess is it Sacramento Steps Forward that has responsibility? Does the advisory board have responsibility? We were talking before about, you know, the application and the planning thing. Actually, we have some real responsibility with that, it sounds like, ultimately. What do we have with the planning time?
Okay. As far as implementation, it would fall to SSF staff. So we would certainly rely on this body to provide guidance on how we more effectively implement the point time. It would be a collaborative effort. Is that what you're asking, John? I'm sorry if I'm misunderstanding.
I'm just trying to figure out what our role is, what really our responsibility is here.
My impression is that we would be guiding it to some extent as an advisory board, and what we're responsible for that, right? So, like, I would love it if we could fix some of these zones. Not only try and maximize the number we go to, but not change any of the zones in the next town, so that we have a standard metric.
Also, I'm thinking if we really do have some responsibility, then over the period of 2 years, we should be working on this. We might even have some part of us that reports to us regularly, like a committee or something. That's why I say I'm not sure how it fits in, but if we really have taken no responsibility, a real responsibility to fill it, I guess.
For me, design and implementation would be through the data committee that I know. Seeking to form that would guide that process. Specific to this topic, I think you bring in folks who are on the ground level to inform what's happening currently.
Yeah.
and that would interact with this advisory board.
Yeah, and certainly if the dollars that we get for the planning grant, that's
fair enough.
And then we have other partners too, the county that historically helped fund this process and the past, that's very helpful.
Thank you, John. And again, I think we want to give our thanks to the team from Sac State. There's such a qualitative improvement this year, and thanks to Ryan for inviting Sac State and Michelle. We did have a bit of defending the thesis.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I love doing this project. It was something, like I said, to involve our students, but this is naturally something I'm interested in, so it was a great challenge.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
And for those, we have another meeting at
10.
15 minutes. So we'll take advantage of this time for a break. And David has one announcement.
If anybody has any people in your programs that are in current need of glasses, BSP will be at Quinn. So today and tomorrow, I'm sure most of you got the notice, but if you haven't yet, please send your people over there to get glasses.
John, I have an announcement also. The Winter Sanctuary RFP is out. It can be found on the Sac County's website. The RFP number is 2018-011. There was a proposers conference yesterday. The deadline for proposals is the 15th, and the awards will be made on the 25th. Winter Sanctuary will operate between 11/20 and April 2nd.
Thank you.
And this is left here, so whoever it is, just remember. Good. Okay. Thank you.
And one last announcement from Sarah.
Hi, I just wanted to let everyone know that we are allocating $368 project-based vouchers that are going in August to the Council on the Board for aid developments. So just wanted to mention the site-based.
Sarah, how many are dedicated to homeless?
All of them.
All of them, okay.
Yeah, they're all dedicated and for eight different developments. And two-thirds of them are for existing units, and one-third of them are for new construction. So we're going to have some units for families. Thank you.
You have to get off at O&P to, because another thing gone, you know, it's all the way over there, 9th Street, KG, in this, or any of that community.
You can also go further down.
If they're on the gold line, but I'm saying, as far as getting off to thinking where these people are going to YOLO, those transitions into the other districts through there, is that's because. No, I know. No, I'm just asking, this is.
I haven't heard
whether what you literally know. As long as you've heard nothing, that to me is, but it's also like, I don't know how long that thing's further down. You know, I bugged him on that. I just bugged him about the Mason's thing.
My guys.
And they busted the door, and that came up through there. So they got the big yellow things out there to make it significant and, you know, visible. So that's a maintenance where the board meeting will be bringing up. How about the snow car? SACOG thinks to there any, when's the proposed, you know, about the steering committee in a meeting yet or not?
I do not know. Basically, has approval to pass the vote. They're assessing themselves. And we're waiting kind of for those next steps, but I don't really have that.
Well, I just figured it was, that was a point to ask, you know, and see what else we can initialize. And check with Ryan about whether those were good questions to ask, too. You know, he invited me sometime if we're working with the Winter Sanctuary. more things. And some other issues. Jeff, I hope you try to be good with feedback. Did it sound like a good question to ask? Identifying what's going on, you know, happening. I mean, like I'm hearing the 710 and J Street, that SRO that's right there where the former 7-Eleven used to be, where everybody from Mental Health came in on J Street. I'm hearing they're discussing about closing that down.
It's closed at the end of the month.
Right. And say, this is so weird in the world because, you know, from memory of mentally issued people, they still keep using that street right there, J Street, to just crash burnings, lay down the sidewalk, and everything else. And where, on one side, you're 11 Dr. Kaiser to be on the initial triage to say, hey, come here, we're sent to the X and Y location places. Also heard, you know, that you're traveling along. Security issues because we deal with 3 and 5 hotel. There's also those concerns. Is it that new to you, or am I reading back stuff you've already
known? No, I think the general issue, we start to see more of this place, so I don't want to call it a lot, but we're homeless and I don't want to see the downtown. The restaurants are stupid. They know the job of coaches and this team because they know it from that, right?
Yeah.
Unless there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But, well, I would like to say I'd love to see the drunken public arrest the folks in the outlying areas who arrest them and drop them downtown, knowing that's a focus place versus taking them on the road. So we're actively doing that. I think part of things with the police is better. It's a jail dumping people downtown without doing proper re-engagement. Oh, okay, we drove you 6 miles away and we arrested you. Now, good luck with no resources.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what's important.
Yesterday, the surprising activities that were taking place going on downtown maybe two, 3 weeks ago, with all the agreements, everything was straight laid as we checked. Unfortunately, on the Thursday night, my Lotus restaurant bombing went down on the another event crew came through here. It was 3 hours. Everybody was focused on street level, not realizing, guess what? We got a level down below that it became fairly good.
My work truck got stolen on Monday. I found it in Reno, Nevada, in a parking lot casino. The casino parking lot in Reno.
Well,
8 hours later.
You can tell, you know, somebody here was wanting to gamble, and they were, you know what I mean?
Dying to get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that's often goes, well, we don't want to advertise where Thunder Valley and the other stops are, but at the same time, you know, it's kind of like, is that one of the things I've tried to suggest to RTEs with all the transit agencies, is wouldn't it be better to make that for a stop on J Street and be your 11th swap on J Street as being set up for your commuters? You know, it's kind of like a
we brought that up on Monday. I think what we need, and why we got a transit guy, I think what we need is consolidated stops. And there needs to be a bus stop for everyone, not just a, oh, this is our bus stop, we're taking it down, we're taking it down. Because what it does is it clusters and falls. So it doesn't make it. If they actually took the sidewalk and made it a track, and we had a lot of shelters that all the buses in front of them, and then it's near a micro station, we need near remote stops. So that's what we want. Hopefully they're trying to look at this bus system where they have it. There's a lot of transportation issues where you don't have a lot of that, but we have that everywhere. We need to force that issue to say it's stupid. We need to waste this public space in that
map. This is kind of with this body right here. I hate this so much negativity. Oh, it's just a butter we are. But from what I see, it's improved. When you're bringing, you know, a body of people together, we may not agree, but consistency of what we're dealing with the subject matter. So,
I mean, do you know how much steps for, you know, when people steps for apologize?
No, I don't really talk. I wouldn't even want to try, you know what I mean? Because I know I hear of, it's SRA just going to their reach literally with that and CD, which is downtown, but you've got about 30,000 managed somewhere
somewhere coming out going further. But, you know, like, this is only 10,000.
I don't know. I'm not going to say it's coming in or not. I can tell you,
But also that disconnect, this is what I'm trying to have our team say.